let's see, can I maintain my practice of connecting this to the preceding lecture? First, I have to remember what the preceding lecture was about. But since it was yesterday, it couldn't be too hard. It was interpretation. There's just a thin connection there, I suppose. If you don't interpret a word correctly, you're probably not in a good position to decide what artistic value it has, if any. So we'll leave it at that. When we think about the issue of artistic value, there's one sort of distinction to make right at the beginning. Are we talking about, we could be talking about the value of art as a whole, art as a sort of institution or practice or realm of human life. And we might ask ourselves, why does that have value? Why is it good that there is such a domain, that there is such a practice? And then we might have a number of things to say in answer to that. And they might be similar to the answers we might give for why the other domains of human life are of value. Why is it good that there's sport, that there's athletic activity, or that there's politics, or that there's cooking or gardening? So we might be able to come up with things that would justify the existence of those practices or activities as a whole. The other kind of question, the one we're going to mainly focus on under the rubric artistic value, is what is the value that individual works of art have? In particular, what makes good works of art good? You know, what is it about them that makes them good in an artistic way? Now, these questions are distinct questions, but they're obviously somewhat related. So, just to make the most obvious connection, one of the answers you might give to why it's valuable that there is the institution or practice of art is, well, it makes it possible to have individual artworks, and some of those individual artworks have a substantial, impressive amount of value. But some of the answers you would give to the question wouldn't connect the two questions so closely. So let's think about the first question, even though it's not the one I want to dwell on for a moment. Why is it a good thing that there is the practice of art as a whole? And before I offer some answers to that, I could position that question a bit differently. You might say, well, you know, why not just have cooking and gardening sex and history and sports? Why isn't that enough? What would art add? What does art add as a domain of life to life? Or you could ask it in the negative sense. If we didn't have art at all, what would be obviously missing from human life? Or in what ways would human life be worse? So now let me go back just to the direct form of the question and see what could one say that's of some, you know, that seems, you know, obviously true, or at least plausible. Well, one thing that art is good for, it's good as a distraction. We know that life is tough, life is hard, and we often need distractions from it. And art, the making and the appreciating and the understanding and the experiencing of art seems to be an excellent distraction from life's cares, from life's worries, and from life's duties. So just in terms of the basic division of sort of work and leisure that human beings seem to require, art is one of the best sources of that second thing, leisure and distraction. But of course, that's not a unique feature of art. One of the things I mentioned a minute ago was obviously a competitor there, and is also a great supplier of distraction and release, namely sports, either participating or viewing them. Another thing that the whole domain of art as a whole offers, I suppose, is a certain kind of challenge. A challenge that is sort of painful or excessively difficult, a challenge that's sort of enjoyable to take on. The challenge of making things, making them interesting perhaps, and the challenge of appreciating, perceiving, and thinking your way into things that other people produce in this vein. Another reward of, say, art as a whole is that it provides a realm in which people can have a sense of accomplishment. A sense of accomplishment seems important to people's lives. It's something you can find in your work or your primary kind of duty, but you can find it elsewhere. And art sometimes allows you to have that sort of sense of accomplishment a little more easily or a little more small scale than, say, the major projects of your life, like getting your PhD degree or, you know, supporting your family. Well, when will you finish supporting your family? Never happens, as it happens. Should I tell the joke about... No, I won't tell that one. I'll give you a tag for it. Maybe you can fill in the joke yourself. It's about the 85-year-old couple who go to the marriage counselor and explain that they want to get a divorce. And then the marriage counselor asks them why. They come up with an interesting answer. That connects to supporting a family your whole life. So supporting a family your whole life and getting a PhD degree and curing cancer, these things take time. And, we need smaller scale accomplishments and successes along the way, and art is a nice sphere for affording that that possibility, both in terms of making, that's an accomplishment, and deciphering or understanding or decoding or getting an artwork. That's a sort of small scale accomplishment. But of course, art has many competitors here as well: sports, gardening, cooking, doing crossword puzzles. Certain days, I just can't get through the day if I don't have one of the easy crossword puzzles from The Guardian or The Independent to do. When I buy the newspaper, it's basically so I have that, 20 minutes from that non-news part of the newspaper. Because otherwise, some days just don't seem to look like they're going to offer any of this sense of accomplishment. So maybe art offers it in a more interesting or more substantial way than some of these other pastimes, but it doesn't offer it uniquely. Another thing that art offers is the opportunity to acquire skills. We know that there's a lot of skill and technique that goes into the making of art, and even in a certain way in the appreciation of art. And it looks like, though, if you plumb this further, it's not clear what it rests on. It looks like having a skill is a good thing, a thing that's valuable, maybe even in itself. And more pertinently, when you acquire skills in the making or appreciating of art, there are often skills that can carry over elsewhere, that have payoffs elsewhere. So if you learn to be a good painter of paintings, well, you might not even be a good painter of moldings. You'd be... Particularly, you'd be less likely to make a mess of it when you're doing fine-grained, small-scale painting of a practical sort. And if you become a good painter, you may develop capacities to analyze the sort of structure of the visual world in ways that would pay off when you become a medical student and have to understand medical diagrams or maybe create some diagrams of your own or learn how to interpret X-rays or photographs of... skin rashes and lesions and so on. So the acquisition of skills is something that the realm of art affords scope for, and those skills are ones that can carry over to other domains. Let me talk about some sort of social benefits of having art. Art often serves as a tool or domain for collective memory, for a community to, as it were, remember things in a kind of vivid and shareable sort of way. Relatedly, you might say that art is a sphere in which traditions, traditional sort of values and events and occurrences can be commemorated, can be as it were, preserved in a way that's appealing and memorable, unlike just sort of writing down in some chronicle in some that'll be put into some dusty drawer and never consulted. Relatedly, the idea the arts can serve as a sort of vehicle of social cohesion, give identity and coherence to social groups, and that's why is that valuable? Well, okay, I'm not going to go into a big sociological digression, but it looks like it's a useful thing for human groups to have that kind of cohesiveness and self-identity and things that can around which solidarity can cohere for various further purposes that that human beings and groups undertake. One obvious example that's talked a bit about, a lot about in recent kind of naturalist aesthetics literature is the use of music as an organizational tool. You know, people marching together to music or working together to music, or feeling sort of empathic kind of rapport together so as to do a joint task more efficiently because of music. And lastly, I'll mention just the fact that some current theorists, which we have some fans of here, focus on things like the fact that art is good for mating. You know, art is good for sexual success. And you might say, okay, that's just good for you know this person. But no, you can put the point more generally. It's good that you know art is a good way in which members of a group can signal sexual interest or attractiveness or fitness to each other, and that you know has ultimately good biological benefits. Otherwise, you know, we'd all be, I guess, wandering around in the dark and mating it haphazardly, and that would be less good. So so that's something that's good about art. It may play a role in you know, sexual mating that produces better results than otherwise would be produced. Okay, when you think about these kinds of things that are the answers to the question of why is it a good thing that there's art as a whole? What's the value of the practice of art as a whole? It's obvious that not all of those answers are going to translate into answers to why a particular artwork is valuable. A particular artwork might be valuable even though it has nothing to do with achieving group solidarity or better sexual selection or even significant leisure or distraction value. And the fact that some of the things I mentioned that make art as a whole valuable, if some of those things do make art as a whole valuable, it doesn't, of course, translate it into a given artwork being valuable in that way. So there's only a kind of rough connection between the two questions and the two kind of answers. But now let's move to that second question, because that's the main focus for today's lecture, and it's the main focus of most writing in aesthetics about the value of art. When people talk about the value of art, they're not talking about the value, these general values of the practice as a whole, but they're talking about the value that inheres in and attaches to individual artworks. So, what makes an individual artwork good? And in particular, what makes it good as art? So what we want to focus on is artistic value, or the value proper to art as art. Because artworks have values that are not artistic, clearly. The most obvious example are these sort of kind of disrespectful kind of examples where an artwork is used, say, as insulation, or an artwork is used to stop a hole, or an artwork is used to prop open a door, and it gets another label, doorstop. Okay, not every artwork can be used this way. Beethoven's Fifth can't be used that way. But a nice, you know, hefty bronze sculpture can be used that way to be as a doorstop, or a nice flat painting taken out of its frame can be used to cover a hole. And a few paintings stacked together could be used as insulation. So these are values that artworks might have, but obviously there would be very minor values of the artworks, A. B, there would be very stupid to use them that way, and three, it's clearly they're not artistic values of the artworks. So artworks clearly have values that are not artistic values. A little less silly example is the example of financial or economic value. Artworks have financial or economic value, at least some of them do, meaning that they command a certain price in the marketplace. But I think almost nobody, except one very perverse colleague I out at Maryland, who once published a paper kind of on this theme, would claim that the financial value of an artwork is somehow, you know, part of its artistic value or equivalent to its artistic value. Some artworks might command very high prices, and as a matter of fact, because you know we've all been hoodwinked or sleeping or corrupted, they actually don't have much artistic value. And, of course, there are many, many artistic value, many, many artworks that have high artistic value, such as the ones that you probably produce in your spare time, or maybe your relatives, which don't have much financial value, or maybe any financial value. You know, put it on eBay and see what happens. I guess nothing happens, has no financial value. But probably it still has some artistic value. Okay, so what we want to focus on primarily is artistic value. These things I wrote on the board, by the way, are four, I think, of the best treatments in recent aesthetics of this topic of artistic value, or its cousin or closely related thing, aesthetic value. And I'll be drawing on some of the discussion in these books, particularly Bud Stecker and Kieran in the rest of the lecture. Okay, so artistic value is our target. And the first thing to say about locating it is that it's closely related to aesthetic value, but it probably shouldn't be equated with aesthetic value. So let me say something about aesthetic value using ideas that I've appealed to on and off during these lectures, but I think mostly in the first and second lectures. Aesthetic value has to do with a certain way of engaging with an object in terms of appreciating its forms, its qualities, and the relationships among them in experience, sort of for its own sake. So an aesthetic experience of something involves sort of essentially perceptual engagement with it, but you can push at it on both sides if you want, say sensuous perceptual or perceptual imaginative, but the perceptual has to be kind of central. And it focuses on the object, qualities and forms, and the meanings or contents that emerge from that, and the relationships of all those things, which, if you remember, if you were here on lecture on form, can be thought of as different levels of form, as it were, as equally well as different levels of content. The relationships between the forms on a lower level and the contents that emerge at a higher level can itself be considered a kind of form. And the point is that the engagement with that, all that, is found to be rewarding or satisfying or intrinsically worthwhile. That's what kind of aesthetic experience is about. So the aesthetic value then of an object is its capacity to afford that kind of engagement, that kind of worthwhile perceptual, imaginative, sensitive, sensuous engagement with its forms, qualities, and interrelationships. Whether that exhausts artistic value, though, will be one of the main things we want to think about. And the position I'll defend, which I think many current writers defend, I'm not sure, these two would certainly defend the idea that artistic value goes beyond aesthetic value. These two are a little less clear. But, okay, so put that bit on hold for a bit. What about some other values that are not so obviously excluded from artistic value, the way, you know, insulation value and doorstep value and financial value are, but aren't so clearly included in it the way aesthetic value is? Like cognitive value, or moral value, or what you might call therapeutic value. Let's say the capacity of artworks to somehow improve our psychic dispositions or frames of mind. Or what's sometimes labeled art historical value, the value that an artwork has because of how it fits into the history of art and has somehow furthered it in some way. Are these part of artistic value? That's what we're going to think about. Oh, here's a few other kinds of value to throw into the mix. Sentimental value is sometimes mentioned. And here I think it's pretty clear, though maybe you could argue the other side, that sentimental value is not part of artistic value. What I mean by sentimental value is the value that an artwork will have, usually you need to specify, to some particular person or persons, because of purely contingent personal connections with the artwork or with some, or with the artwork on some occasion. So an example, say, that I could use is there's a piece of chamber music by Beethoven called Quintet for Piano and Winds. And that has a certain sentimental value for me for two reasons. One is because I used it as the kind of, you know, stock example in one of my best-known essays on what a musical work is. I'm not sure why I used that, but I used it, so then I had to talk about it, and it's part of that little essay, that essay which is part of my intellectual biography. And then, quite amazingly, it happened to be the music that was playing on the intercom in the hospital when my daughter was being delivered, or right after. I said, wow, the world, the universe is properly ordered, and everything's looking good. Alright, but neither of these things that make this piece have a sort of sentimental value for me are in any way part of its artistic value, and even I, for whom it has that sentimental value, recognize that. They don't, that sentimental value doesn't in any way make it better as art. That said, of course, it is a nice piece of music. You wouldn't think I would choose a bad piece of music as a linchpin of my essay, would you? But, so you should listen to it sometime. It's a very nice piece. Less heaven-storming and, fist-pumping than a lot of Beethoven. Anyway, its value largely consists in its being kind of beautiful, well-crafted, a nice expression of a string of feelings, and doesn't in any way consist in the fact that it has a sort of place in my intellectual or emotional biography. Okay, so sentimental value is probably another example of a value that artworks can have, and that's going to be a person-relative value. Well, I mean, I suppose there could be some artworks that are really kind of have a universal sentimental value. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the Star Spangled Banner has a kind of universal sentimental value for all, or almost all Americans. Does it? But in any case, the point is that whether it's person-relative or universal or quasi-universal, like nationally shared, it's not a part of artistic value. Here's one last kind of value that I'll talk about, which is in this gray area, purely religious or ritual value. So a lot of, you know, crucifixions and pietas and so on perform a role of allowing worshippers to sort of focus on or remember what, you know, the cult items are of their religion while they're worshiping, but it's not clear that they're really looking at those things in any way or appreciating them aesthetically or appreciating their art historical significance or anything like that. So, but that's a value that religious artworks have. I mean, by religious artworks, I mean artworks that represent, you know, significant themes or entities or features of a religion, religious doctrine. It's not clear that would count as artistic value, even though it is a value and it's an important value. So the ones that are in the gray area that we may be able to make a case for being part of artistic value that I've mentioned are things like moral value, cognitive value, maybe therapeutic value, you know, mood enhancing value. These things may be part of artistic value. We have to see what kind of arguments or like shreds of argument you might give for that. And yet they're not the same as aesthetic value. Well, I'll probably tease these apart at some point, but they aren't the kind of value that consists in a sort of valuable experience. So they're not that core part of artistic value that we call aesthetic value. Okay, so how can we decide whether some of these other values, cognitive, moral, therapeutic, or maybe one that I mentioned under the, you know, why is the practice of art valuable at all rubric, maybe things like, you know, social cohesion building power of an artwork, you know, maybe that's part of its artistic value. How can we decide how far to cast our net? How many values apart from purely aesthetic value would constitute artistic value? Okay, that's a hard question. I'm not sure what to say, and there isn't really agreement by current theorists about how to decide this. But here are some things you might appeal to. you might try to think, well, what is the purpose of artworks? Or if that seems too global a question, what is the purpose of a given art form, or at least of some or a lot of artworks in a given art form? What is it really supposed to be doing? And then, if you can identify things that it's supposed to be doing, and some of those things are not simply the provision of, you know, rewarding aesthetic experience, then you could say, well, that's part of the value of the art when it actually achieves that purpose, when it achieves that purpose, whether it's moral instruction or cognitive illumination or mood enhancement or whatever. Maybe we should look to the intentions with which artists create works. What are artists trying to achieve primarily or essentially in making artworks? What do viewers or appreciators or connoisseurs of that art form tend to seek or tend to consider important in the pursuit of that art form? Maybe that's at least a prima facie indication of what would count as an artistic value. Maybe we should look to criticism, to sort of look to the body of criticism. Well, we need to qualify that somewhere. The body of respected or professional or informed criticism in a given art form and see what it focuses on. And maybe that'll show us what things count as artistic value and what things don't count as artistic value. As I say, beyond what is sort of incontestably a part of artistic value, namely its, you know, aesthetic value. I'm not sure what criterion is really just there or how to answer that question, but it's an important question to figure out what is the basis for including some things in artistic value and not others. A question I'm going to come back to at the end, so I'll just note it here. It's the one I'm most interested in because I've been trying to think about most. It looked like an adverb is needed here, but the adjective didn't sound right. Most hardly? No, it's not the one I'm trying to think about most hardly. It's not what I'm hardly thinking about. It's the one I've been trying to think about the hardest. That's not right either. It's what I've been thinking about. And I haven't yet made up my mind about it. Namely, it's this question, whether all of a work's artistic value can be cashed out in terms of its experience value. That's closely related to the question of whether all artistic value consists in aesthetic value, because aesthetic value is clearly an experiential value. But experiential value is maybe a broader idea. So the idea is, are there aspects of artistic value that aren't grounded in or aren't cashed out in terms of the experiences that we can have of artworks? And I'm thinking primarily of the experiences of, you know, viewers or appreciators or audiences, but maybe you could broaden that as well and talk about the experiences of creators as well, in addition. And why would one think that there are some values that go beyond what can be experienced? Because there are a number of values that current theorists, most pronouncedly, I'd say, Matthew Kieran in this book, emphasize, which consist in accomplishments or achievements that artworks embody or contain. And it looks as if, at least on first glance, that these are values. It's a value that the artwork has done something, has achieved something, has accomplished something, whether or not anyone experiences it, or whether or not it is, you know, cash outable in terms of experiences, positive experiences of appreciators. And I myself have written things in this vein. Most clearly when I wrote a long review of this book, a critical notice of this book, because this is a book which does hold basically that artistic value consists in aesthetic value. So the main thesis of this book is to deny that these other things that look like plausible candidates: moral value, educational value, cognitive value, art historical value, really can be part of artistic value. I've certainly been thinking about this for a while, and at least when I wrote that critical notice, I was convinced that there were these values that didn't cash out in terms of experience. And as I say, the rubric that covers most of these values is something like achievement or accomplishment. And more specifically, what kinds of achievement or accomplishment am I talking about? Well, originality, the development of an original style, say, or the development of an imaginative vision of the world that is unprecedented. That's another, say, kind of originality. Or just the demonstration of skill or dexterity. When we look at certain artworks, particularly like old master Netherlandish paintings, we think, how could he possibly have made that person's face quite so distinct and captured all the folds and wrinkles of the face or of the clothing, of the tapestry, of the rug? It's just, it's incredible. How can people do that? Another example that's used is artistic problems. It looks as if artworks sometimes solve artistic problems, and we value them because they do that. Or we think of a whole style or a whole movement as solving an artistic problem. Two examples that are often mentioned here are, say, Cézanne. Cézanne developed his style as a way of solving an artistic problem. What problem? The problem of retaining the freshness and brightness of Impressionist color and Impressionist ways of seeing the visible world, while yet capturing some of the feel and solidity of the what he called the old master paintings. And Cézanne came up with a special style of kind of pre-cubist sort of fragmentation and facetization of a surface that, in a way, is sort of captures some of what Impressionist paintings did, but also achieves this sense of solidity that Cézanne was after, that he admired in the old masters, painters like Chardin and Caravaggio or Titian. Okay, so that's another kind of example that's used, that the solution of an artistic problem. And I guess the last thing I'll mention is influence. It's sometimes thought that influence is part of what makes an artwork good as art, that it exerts, well, here you really need the adjective positive, exerts a positive influence on the future of art. And that, again, is not something that obviously doesn't seem to consist obviously in an experience that it's affording to observers. That's probably the clearest one that doesn't seem to consist in an experience. If an artwork is partly good because it is led to some other artworks that are of value, well, then that's a relational fact about the causal history of the artwork. It's not a matter of providing you some kind of direct experience that's valuable. Unless you say something like, well, thinking about how this work led to some future work is somehow valuable. That's a very that doesn't seem to have much plausibility. The influentiality, the value of the influentiality, can't really be a matter of it being pleasant to think that this work led to that other work and that opened up new channels of artistic expression. No, the value has got to be in the fact that it did create that space for a new kind of art, and so on and so forth. I say so on and so forth because I'm going to come back to this at the end, I hope, and then suggest how maybe there is another side to this story, and these kinds of examples of non-experientially based value, when pushed further, end up being experiential in the back door. But at least that's one of the things that I'm still thinking about. I'm not sure about, but I'll express some of those thoughts at the end. Okay, I'm going to speed up if I'm going to keep to my promise today. Okay, I want to introduce another strand for thinking about strand of thought for thinking about artistic value more, broadly, more just as opposed to simply equating artistic value and aesthetic value. An idea I need to develop this line of thought is the idea of instrumental value. There's a standard distinction in the theory of value between intrinsic value and instrumental value. And something has intrinsic value if it has value in itself considered apart from all other objects. So it would have that kind of value even if nothing else existed, even if it had no relations to anything else. When you take that kind of criterion strictly, it's not clear that anything has intrinsic value. But the standard candidates for what might have intrinsic value are things like experiences, or maybe, you know, sets of experiences like that would constitute a life. Maybe those sorts of things are valuable in themselves, even if there's nothing else. There's nothing else at all, or nothing else that they're related to. But almost everything else you can think of doesn't look like it's a good candidate for intrinsic value, a value that something would have in itself apart from any relation to anything else. Take food. Does food have intrinsic value? Is it a good thing that there is food if there was like nothing else in the whole world except, you know, this one apple? No, it doesn't seem as if that makes sense. Food is good because it nourishes creatures. You know, so its goodness is clearly instrumental. It's good for something else. Money is a standard example of something that we all like, or almost everyone likes, but it doesn't have any intrinsic value. It's only good because you can hand it to people and they give you other things that are a little more promising as valuable, but even most of them are only, you know, instrumentally valuable, like a shovel. Because you can do things with it. And what kind of things? You can dig holes. Maybe holes are intrinsically valuable. No. But maybe the pleasure you get out of looking at a hole, maybe that's intrinsically valuable. It's getting a little more plausible to think that. But remember that I said a minute ago, the obvious candidates for things that might be intrinsically valuable would be experiences and lives. And the pleasure at looking at a hole, that's a kind of experience. I'll just mention a point here that's always mentioned before I get back to my main topic. One problem with thinking that pleasures are intrinsically valuable is that people will object that it depends on the object. So if you're taking a pleasure in, you know, someone nastily torturing somebody else, then that's not a good thing. So not all pleasures are intrinsically good. So most values are instrumental values. Most objects have only instrumental value. Maybe all objects have only instrumental value, and maybe only experiences in the right context or lives have intrinsic value. So if we now turn our focus back to art, it's sometimes, or it's rather often, loosely said that artworks have intrinsic value. That's what distinguishes them from things like shovels and money and cakes, which are clearly instrumental. That artworks are sort of purer or better because they have intrinsic value. But clearly that's an exaggeration. What people mean when they say artworks have intrinsic value is that the main value of artworks is what I've been calling aesthetic value, that is, say, the provision of experiences that are worth having and enjoyable and satisfying or rewarding in their own right. But if so, then it's the experiences that are intrinsically valuable. The artworks aren't intrinsically valuable. They are the means, the instruments to having those experiences. Or even if we recall the line I was tentatively pushing a minute ago, that some artworks are valuable because they embody sort of achievements or accomplishments, the artworks then are still sort of instrumentally valuable because they are the vehicles or the embodiments of the achievements, which maybe are closer to being intrinsically valuable. So looked at soberly, the view that artworks are intrinsically valuable is not really probably sustainable. But one knows what people are getting at there. They're saying that unlike utilitarian objects, the main value of artworks is to enable people to have experiences, and maybe those experiences are intrinsically valuable. (Clears throat) Okay, once we get clear that artistic value is going to be instrumental value, pretty much, even the core of it, which is called aesthetic value, that's an instrumental value because it's the capacity of the painting or the symphony to afford that kind of rewarding perceptual imaginative experience. Once we grant that, then there should be less, at least initial opposition, to thinking that some of the other values I talked about before, moral value, cognitive value, therapeutic value, aren't artistic. Why? Because a kind of simple kind of knee-jerk argument for putting those values out of the realm of the artistic is, well, those values are instrumental, but artistic values can't be instrumental, therefore they can't be part of artistic value. But that argument doesn't work once you realize that basically all artistic values are probably instrumental, or at least the core artistic value, which is aesthetic value, is instrumental. On the other hand, this doesn't prove that those other instrumental values are artistic, but at least it suggests that them being instrumental is not what's going to disqualify them. Okay, so now let's focus on them for a minute. If a given artwork can afford moral insight, if it has the power to give people moral insight, or a greater grasp of the subtleties of human motivation, or a deeper understanding of the emotional terrain, these are things that we sometimes say great, you know, novels and poems and films can afford us. This kind of emotional, moral, psychological knowledge or enhancement. Well, does it count as artistic value? That's the hard thing. That's the thing that's hard to decide. Its being instrumental doesn't sort of settle the issue, because perhaps all artistic value is instrumental. A worry, though, is that you can get moral insight and psychological penetration and a deeper grasp of the realm of the emotions in other ways. You know, by talking to other people, by reading psychology textbooks, listening to well-thought-out, well-reasoned, well-intentioned sermons, maybe. So what special role will artworks have in affording these kind of goods? That's a fair question. It's a question that's often been raised. Is there something distinctive about the way art can afford, you know, moral insight or cognitive improvement? And maybe the answer is, maybe there's something distinctive about the way art does it, but there's no reason to deny that you can get that kind of result from other sources. But then, does this count as an artistic value of the artwork, that it can provide those kind of cognitive or moral rewards? Here's at least one thing to say to sort of preserve it as a candidate for being artistic value, that when an artwork provides moral insight or cognitive illumination or something of that sort, what we usually value or what we should value is the particular way in which the artwork does that. Now, sometimes this is made into a thesis about the inseparability of the reward, the inseparability of the insight or of the cognitive illumination or the moral penetration to the way that it's achieved, so that they aren't really detachable. And you can go that way, but I don't think that's all that plausible. So you take something like a really subtle work of literature, like novels of Henry James, and there's a philosopher named Martha Nussbaum who likes to use them as examples of works that can afford moral and cognitive illumination of a very subtle kind. And when you read one of these novels with understanding, you get a better grip on the subtleties and the possibilities of human interactions and what kinds of virtues can be displayed and how and what kind of failings can arise through negligence or obtuseness. But do you want to say that what you understand when you read a Henry James novel with care and perhaps have a sympathetic critic like Nussbaum herself or some other great literary critic to help you see what's in them, that the insight you get is not detachable, it's not expressible apart from the particular novel. Some people have made that kind of claim, but then you're reduced to, if someone says, well, what did you learn from reading, you know, The Ambassadors or The Golden Bowl? And you say, well, you got a few hours, and then you sit there and you just read the whole novel to them. And you say, see? Okay, that doesn't seem like a totally satisfactory position to end up in. So I think you want to be able to say that the insight or the illumination or the cognitive enrichment can be expressed in other ways and can be manifested in other ways. So maybe it is to some extent detachable from the vehicle, the film or the novel that conveys it to you. But what I think is helpful to say is not that, but rather that when we appreciate the cognitive enrichment or the moral insight that the work of art affords us, we're always appreciating it as having been vehicled by and as having been embodied in and communicated by the specific form of the artwork, by the specific, all the specific qualities, textures, and actual structures, sounds, images, and so on of the artwork itself. And if you focus on that, I sometimes like to think of that as the complex of the work's content and its, and the vehicle that embodies it. If you focus on that, then you're focusing on something that is unique to that artwork, and also focusing on that, you're focusing on something that's maybe distinctive about artistic appreciation, is that we're never solely concerned with the detachable rewards or insights or benefits, but always by the way in which they are embodied or communicated or vehiculed by the artwork. Okay, having said that, where does that leave the view that these values are instrumental values, values of moral insight or cognitive illumination? I think it leaves it intact. They are instrumental values. Where does it leave the question of how distinctive is the reward that you get of this sort from an artwork? It isn't necessarily distinctive, but it may be that, I didn't say before, that artworks are particularly good at conveying some of these kinds of insights because of the close connection between artworks and ways of perceiving or feeling the world. So maybe they're a particularly good vehicle for conveying, moral and psychological insight, better than a psychology lecture or just talking to a semi-informed neighbor about such and such. But I don't think we have to insist that they are rewards or insights that can only be gotten through art. However, when you look to the appreciation of the artwork, it is always an appreciation, at least always properly an appreciation, of those rewards as brought about in a certain way through a very specific, distinctive artistic vehicle. But rewards they are, benefits they are, in a way that makes them not reducible to the experience per se by which they are conveyed. So take specifically, say something like the heightening or invigoration of consciousness that we get from certain artworks, from great artworks that make you feel more alive and give you a new, renewed sense of the joy of living. So some of Matisse's paintings, or Keats' greatest poems, or Beethoven's symphonies, that this kind of effect, this heightening or invigoration of consciousness, well, that occurs during the experience of listening to the symphony or reading the poem, thinking about the poem. But it may also produce a lasting effect, an effect that outruns the actual experience of the poem or the symphony. This sort of spillover effect, say, let's call it increased psychic well-being. Your life, or put it this way, maybe this is too crude, but isn't it just that your life is better when you're reading and savoring a sonnet by Keats or listening to Beethoven's Fourth Symphony, but your life is better afterwards as a result of having listened to them, that you're in better psychic form. You're more together, as people sometimes say. Maybe you're just plain happier. So here we have something that is an effect. It is an effect. It's not just the experience itself. And the question is that part of the artistic value of Keats' sonnet or of Beethoven's symphony? Not just that it can give you an intrinsically rewarding perceptual experience when you engage in it, but that experience tends to have good psychic effects that sort of last. Is that part of its artistic value? I'm not sure, but I'm inclined to count that. I'm not sure I have a good argument for counting that, but it would seem to me something that should count. And of course I mean that it has this kind of power in a reliable or regular way. It's a robust capacity, not just kind of purely accidental thing that happens to one person on one occasion, but that it is generally psychically integrating or uplifting or some other positive psychological effect you might name. Let me make this point, which sometimes is challenged. I said that aesthetic value is sometimes loosely thought to be intrinsic value, but that can't really be right. The aesthetic value of an artwork is a matter of its sustaining or enabling experiences, and maybe they are intrinsically valuable. So if you really focus on the artwork itself, even the greatest, most beautiful, most sublime artworks, and here I'm disagreeing for so that those of you who know it, with a famous discussion at the end of G. Moore's Principia Ethica, where he talks about a kind of a beautiful planet where there's just no one else around. There's nothing else around, but there's this beautiful planet. Would it still be beautiful? Well, of course, I said it was beautiful, didn't I? But anyway, a planet that we would consider beautiful, and yet imagine there's no sentient life, and there never has been, never will be. Is it still beautiful? That's the question. My view on this, though I have wavered on this point, is that it's not. Even the greatest, most beautiful, most sublime artwork, whether you're talking about planet or artwork, doesn't matter here. And maybe the planet is an artwork. Who knows? Maybe we're all part of some of the fine details of this major, soon-to-be, is it called Turner Prize? Turner Prize-winning artwork. So even the greatest, most beautiful, most sublime artwork is not intrinsically valuable. It's not valuable in itself apart from its relation to other things. So absent the possibility of sentient beings who are able to appreciate such works, these works don't actually have any value. Or rather, wouldn't have any value. Of course, they do have value, because there are appreciators. Let's see. Here's another aspect of this issue I haven't mentioned yet. I talked about aesthetic value, artistic value, how aesthetic value is the core of artistic value, but maybe there are other kinds of values, and most of them instrumental, that you might want to include in artistic value. The value that's proper to an artwork as art. Granted that, of course, some values we know clearly couldn't count as artistic value. Things like insulation value and financial value, and probably sentimental value. But here's another point. If aesthetic value is the core artistic value, does that mean that all artistically good artworks have some aesthetic value? Or put it another way, in order for an artwork to have some to have artistic value, does it have to have some aesthetic value? Or alternatively, again, are there some artistically good artworks that have no aesthetic value? And what that means is, are there artistically good artworks that basically don't afford any kind of intrinsically satisfying perceptual, imaginative, sensuous experience? The obvious examples here are what are generally called conceptual art. Conceptual artworks seem to play with ideas and seem to be things that are kind of intellectually engaging, and yet often don't have any appealing sensory perceptual form to them, or at least, or in some cases don't even look like they have any kind of perceptual form to them. They are, as conceptual artists sometimes say, just pure ideas or pure thoughts. Now, as a matter of fact, I think that there is no conceptual art that is pure thought. I think there's always some kind of sensory, concrete embodiment or anchoring of the artwork. Otherwise, it really can't be an artwork that you can connect to or associate with a particular maker. But even if that point is correct, the concrete embodiment of the artwork is often very minimal. You know, it can be a piece of paper, it can be an index card with a few words written on it. Can be a in the case of the erased de Kooning, it's a sort of blank paper, though there's creases on it, that used to be a drawing by de Kooning that was erased by another artist named Rauschenberg, and it was exhibited as just that. It's one of the icons of early conceptual art, and people smiling, and everyone smiles when they think about this. But it looks like you don't have to see it. You can just think about it and get it. And if you did see it, it's not clear without air. So conceptual art is often offered as an example of art that's somehow good, seems successful in some way or other, but without achieving that goodness via its perceptual appeal. Another example would be the appropriational photographs of Sherry Levine. I like this example a lot. I mention it a lot. So Sherry Levine is a photographer whose basic corpus consists of having re-photographed other photographers' photographs. So when you look at a Sherry Levine photograph, you might think you're just looking at a Walker Evans photograph or a Paul Strand photograph, but in fact it's a photograph of those photographs. And it basically looks indistinguishable. And yet it's not a Walker Evans, it's a Sherry Levine. Okay, so here there's some kind of funny game going on about the uniqueness of art and the absence or irrelevance of the artist, or the way in which identities can be appropriated and reprojected. But in any case, in terms of what you're looking at, there's nothing there that's aesthetically distinctive of Sherry Levine's work. All you're seeing aesthetically is what you could see in the Walker Evans photograph. So if you subtract all that, there's no aesthetic appeal to the re-photographing. So its appeal must reside elsewhere. And another example I like, I'll mention here, is because today I even have the right name of it. It's called Vertical Mile Kilometer. Vertical Earth Kilometer, sorry. Vertical Earth Kilometer, and the artist's name is Walter DiMaria. And did I mention this work here before? Okay, this is a work of conceptual art in a sense. It's not the purest conceptual art, because it's definitely, it has a very concrete material embodiment. It consists of a kilometer-long copper rod that was inserted into a hillside near Kassel, Germany. And then you don't see it. I think there's like a little cover on the top, like a tiny manhole cover. Maybe if you went to the site, you'd see that. And it goes all the way down into the earth, and it's there. It's mind-blowing to think about it, but you don't really have to see it. And most people who talk about it have never seen it. And did he actually really do it? Who knows? Maybe it doesn't even exist. I think there's evidence that exists. And I would like to go to that site and see it, or at least be in its vicinity. But so taking the facts the way they are, it's a conceptual artwork with a real material base, but it looks like the perceptual qualities aren't really relevant because you don't see that thing. At most, you have a pseudo-perceptual experience of imagining it. But then take the example further, because it could very well have been that it was an even purer conceptual piece whereby de Maria had claimed to have done this and given everyone that idea, but actually never did do it. It wouldn't be too much different. It would be somewhat different, but it wouldn't be too much different. And then, clearly, the perceptual appeal of it would be even less. Okay, so it looks as if it's possible that there are works that have artistic value that don't have aesthetic value, or at least don't have any significant or important aesthetic value, so their value seems to reside elsewhere. Okay, well, what kind of value is that these icons of conceptual art have? It might fit under one of the rubrics we've mentioned already. It might be a kind of cognitive value. Sort of, there's a value in playing with or contemplating the ideas that the artist has set in play by that kind of, let's call it a gesture, that kind of a move in artistic space. It's a kind of cognitive value. I haven't seen anyone ever use this rubric, but maybe this is a place where you might want to say there's a thing called imaginative value. And it's not the same as cognitive value, it's not the same as perceptual sensuous value either. Maybe some artworks afford that, even though they don't afford the other kinds. A few more words on cognitive value. Cognitive value, very bluntly viewed, would be conveying information or conveying facts or getting people, enabling people to know things they didn't know before. But that's a sort of flat-footed way to think about cognitive value, and that's not probably the cognitive value that's most important in art. If art has cognitive value, it doesn't look like its main value is conveying facts or information that you didn't have before. That's the cognitive value of an encyclopedia, even Wikipedia. Oh, I noticed that Wikipedia did Encarta in recently. Encarta has been just removed. That was sort of Microsoft's attempt to have a kind of web encyclopedia, but Encarta has been withdrawn. If anyone that subscribes to it, you can get a refund, apparently, now, because it's dead. Wikipedia is sort of taking its place. So that's the kind of cognitive value that we want from newspapers, what we'd like to get from newspapers and encyclopedias and so on. The cognitive value of art isn't going to consist basically in conveying new facts or information. It's going to consist in other things that are cognitive, such as artworks can remind us of what we already know in the abstract, but give us a more heightened or concrete kind of appreciation of it. And a lot of people who talk about moral knowledge from art are really thinking of it in that way. So a play about sexist behavior, or a play about the mistreatment of blacks in the South in the early 20th century is not going to convey information to most people that they don't know, but it's going to get them to appreciate it more vividly and in a more concrete form. This line about moral knowledge is taken by Noel Carroll and others who pay a lot of attention to the moral lessons that works of art might afford us. So they're not going to tell us things we don't know, but they're going to give us concrete realizations of these facts that will give us a heightened appreciation of them. And artworks can also be cognitively valuable, not because they convey facts at all, whether concrete or abstract, whether reminders or news, but because they improve our powers. They improve our cognitive powers. They help hone our powers of observation and discrimination. That may be one of the rewards you get from close attention to paintings, whether abstract or representational, that you can see other things, the world around you more penetratingly as a result of the practice you've had in seeing into organizing your perception of paintings. I mentioned imaginative value a minute ago. Well, maybe this is imaginative value, but it looks like it has a kind of cognitive value because the imagination is a faculty that is instrumental in giving us knowledge, like knowledge of, you know, of the future, a knowledge of you know, what plans are reasonable to execute. You need an imagination to arrive at those kind of assessments. So artworks can serve to exercise our imaginations and to make our imaginations more, you know, more flexible and more powerful. Self-understanding, self-knowledge is the sort of thing that artworks might help you achieve. You sort of can work through your own, you know, problems by identifying with and kind of getting inside of the minds and reactions of characters. Artworks can not only give you more, say, powers of discriminating or analyzing your environment, but they may just make you more sensitive to aesthetic features of the environment. Why is that the case? Well, I give a kind of, again, a very flat-footed explanation. Their artworks, by and large, present more aesthetic properties and more interesting or subtle ones than the, you know, average, you know, 100 square meters of the world you happen to be looking at. But once... No? Oh, I thought you were saying clear. I think, gee, okay. So... I'll just continue. Artworks may present more subtle, more complicated aesthetic features than the average randomly selected bit of the environment. But then when you look back at the ordinary environment surrounding you, you may be more sensitive to the aesthetic properties that it has. And here's one I like that I mentioned in an essay I wrote once on pictorial representation, I think. That when you, one of the benefits of, say, reading novels, and maybe to a less extent doing films, is that you get a kind of stock of characters through which to rethink the world. You have these characters that are vividly vividly represented in a detailed fashion, and you can kind of see people in terms of them. Now, sometimes that's a way of not seeing people, but if used with discretion, it can be a way of sort of focusing, ah, he's a Gradgrind, or oh, that's an Anna Karenina, or oh, I see, yes, he's kind of like Raskolnikov. These are kind of lenses for viewing the world and organizing and, you know, sharpening your perception of people's characters and psychology, personality that you can take away as a kind of movable reward or power from artworks like the great novels and films. Lenses for seeing and organizing the world, include mostly, most importantly, other people through them. Okay, so that's kind of cognitive value, which is plausibly a kind of artistic value, but it's cognitive value in a broader sense than just giving you information or conveying facts. Okay. Two last things then now. I've raised the question of how to, on what principle or what criterion are we going to include these other values as artistic values? We know that aesthetic value is clearly part of artistic value. We know, don't ask how we know, but it seems obvious that financial value and doorstopper value are not part of artistic value. I've mentioned other kinds of values, therapeutic value, moral value, cognitive value, imaginative value, that look like they might be considered part of artistic value. Well, what sort of criterion could we at least throw out as a possibility for why we're including those, whereas we're not going to include, let's take my clearest examples, financial value, sentimental value, and doorstopper value. Here's a suggestion. This suggestion is found in just a, you know, kind of throwaway paragraph in this book. I'm surprised it wasn't sort of foregrounded a little more. The suggestion is that... these beyond aesthetic values that count as part of artistic value are ones that are consequent on understanding and appreciating an artwork, or which presuppose such understanding and appreciation. So put otherwise, to grasp that a work has, say, these are the ones that, you know, I'm trying to make a case for including, to grasp that a work has, for example, moral, cognitive, or therapeutic, you know, mood or life-enhancing value, and what exactly that consists in, requires you to have an understanding experience of the work. So you can't really even see why the work would be said to have cognitive value or imaginative value or moral insight value or mood enhancement value unless you would experience the work. So you need to have an understanding experience of the work to see that those values hold, to see that the work has those values. Whereas, to grasp the work as economic value, you don't need to experience the work. You don't have to have an understanding experience of the work. You just have to know that that was the price that it commanded at Sotheby's, or that it would command. And to know that it has insulation value or doorstopper value is just to see that it has the physical properties that are required for that sort of thing, but you don't really have to experience it. If you're just told that it weighs 10 pounds, you don't have to look at it. You just know it has, you know, doorstopper value. And sentimental value, well, again, that one seems a little harder to put aside, but because it involves something like an experience. But you can know that something has a sentimental value for someone without experiencing it yourself. If it's just you know that this is something that was played on the night that they were wed, then you'll know that it's a song that has sentimental value for them. Or at least, you know, until they got divorced, and that has negative sentimental value for them. But you don't need to experience it yourself. So that's a kind of possible criterion for identifying this category of artistic value as being broader than aesthetic value, but not obviously including all values that an artwork has. It just includes those that are closely connected to an understanding experience of the work, such that, well, let's put it this way in another formulation I have here in front of me. Artistic values turn out to be ones that are either inherent in the aesthetic values, or at least flow from and depend on an understanding experience of the work. Okay, now the last point is to go back to these examples that are often discussed to make the case that there are artistic values that don't cash out in terms of experience. I'll remind you what they were. Things like originality of style, originality of vision, or influentiality, seminality of a work, or the imaginative expression of, say, a kind of emotion or realm of emotion that a given work of art might embody, or the skill or dexterity that seems exhibited in a work of art, such as a very, very detailed, hyper-naturalistic old Flemish painting, or a solution to an artistic problem. These look like they are values because something has been accomplished or achieved, and that what has been achieved or accomplished doesn't require that someone has a valuable experience of, you know, of as it were, appreciating that experience, appreciating that accomplishment or achievement. But now, in these last few minutes, let's just look at these accomplishments and achievements more closely and ask both exactly how they're valuable and why the value that they possess is rightly considered artistic value. When you do this, it's not clear to me, and this is my thought is really unsettled on this point, it's not clear to me that there isn't ultimately a connection with valuable experiences, after all. Before I try to spell that out in connection with a few of those examples, let me just mention, this is sort of in worrying about whether the achievement is valuable in itself or whether the achievement is somehow only valuable because it connects to experiences of, it's a little too circular, but it'll do for now, appreciating the achievement, There's an echo here of a very old problem. It's basically the Euthyphro problem in Plato, which I'm sure most of you have heard about. In the Euthyphro, the issue that's being discussed, that's now labeled, you know, the Euthyphro problem or the Euthyphro dilemma or something like that, is this. Piety is the theme of the Euthyphro. What is piety? What is, you know, proper behavior more broadly? And at one point in the discussion, what emerges is that there are two possibilities, and it's hard to decide between them. The two possibilities are that acts or behavior is pious because the gods approve that kind of act. But the other possibility is that the gods approve that kind of act because the acts are pious. So the question is piety something independent of the fact that the gods approve that kind of behavior? If not, then the piety just is the fact that the gods approve that sort of behavior. But the other side of the coin, which probably Socrates is more inclined to defend, is that the piety is something else, is something independent of the approval by the gods, and it's the reason why the gods approve those acts. So, again, the Euthyphro dilemma is, are acts approved by the gods pious because the gods approve them? Or do the gods approve them because they are pious? And if it's the latter, then you need to say what the piety consists in, and you can't simply say, well, it's because the gods approve it. Otherwise, there wouldn't be no explanatory value to saying the gods approve it because it's pious. Because you'd just be saying the gods approve it because the gods approve it. Okay, this is the issue I'm talking about now, about whether achievements and accomplishments in art can be cashed out in terms of experiences or not, isn't exactly the same as the Euthyphro problem, but at least anyway, I think it's related. Okay, so now, finally, why might you think that developing an original style, developing an imaginative, novel vision of the vision of the visible world through a way of painting, being influential in terms of the history of art, solving an artistic problem, might themselves be valuable because of the connection to experience at some point? Well, take the Cézanne example. I said Cézanne solved an artistic problem. Well, what was the artistic problem? It was the problem of reconciling some of the kind of colorful freedom and joy of Impressionist pictures and their look with the sense of solidity and clear sort of spatial structure and object depiction that you get in Old Master painting. And so he somehow solved that problem, let's take it, with the style that he developed. But why is that an artistic problem? It's an artistic problem because it is a way of achieving a kind of balance between those two kinds of experiences that were considered valuable. That's the kind of joy of Impressionist color and the sort of sense of feeling of solidity of a space that wasn't quite as, you know, vaporous and as insubstantial as the space in, say, a late Monet painting. So what's being reconciled, what's being, you know, captured there is something that does relate to experiences in a certain way. It's a, you know, if the problem had been something like, well, how can you paint a painting that's red and yet 8 feet by 8 feet square? Well, someone would say, well, what? That's okay. First of all, it doesn't seem very hard. Why is that a problem? But anyway, if you somehow figure out how to do it, you just make a big enough canvas and have enough paint on hand, that you wouldn't call that solving an artistic problem because it doesn't seem to connect to anything like appreciation. But what Cézanne solved was an artistic problem because it connected to experiences that he was trying to reconcile and, you know, capture together in a given kind of painting. And our sense of having solved the problem really we can't really give sense to the idea that he solved that problem without talking about a kind of valuable experience that he makes possible that has some of the value or some of the features of the experiences that he was trying to combine, as it were. Or if we think about influentiality, an artwork is said to be good because it influences the future of art in a positive direction. Well, what does that mean? That means that it leads to the creation of other artworks that have some artistic value. Well, what does that mean? Okay, well, maybe they lead to the creation of other works that have artistic value. Oh, look, at some point it looks like you have to cash that out in terms of works that are actually satisfying to experience. Otherwise, the fact that a given artwork has a positive effect on the future of art would seem as if it's a purely, you know, it's a purely formal property of it, like causing more things. But causing more things can't itself be a ground of value. You have to cause more things that eventually lead to, as it were, experiences that are valuable in themselves. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't call that artistic value. You would just call that, oh, it has causal value, something like that. So if you press on what's good about a work being influential or seminal, it looks like it has to not just cause more artworks, but eventually they have to be artworks that have some kind of artistic value of another kind. And the obvious other kind is, you know, aesthetic value. Or just take one more example. Originality. Originality is doing things in a different way, creating a different style. But take particularly the example of Cubism, the development of Cubism, especially early analytical Cubism. It embodies a different way of seeing objects and of decomposing them and recomposing them in a way that allows them to still be recognizable but sort of seen differently. So that style enabled that kind of seeing, let's say. And so it's original and novel for that reason. But suppose you then posited that, well, there was never any intrinsic value, or there is never any, well, okay, say intrinsic value in seeing things that way. Then it's not clear why that novel style, that sort of originality, would have value. So once again, it looks like originality is doing something different that leads to new kinds of artworks. Influentiality is creating the possibility of new artworks. What's my other example? Solving an artistic problem, again, means that artworks can be created in a way they weren't created before. But is any of that really valuable unless at some point there's some kind of works that are produced that are, you know, valuable in some other way? And once again, maybe there won't always have to be aesthetic value, but that's the most obvious other way. And if these non-aesthetic artistic values, because I'm not denying that they are artistic values and that they are non-aesthetic per se, if they never related to experiences that were valuable in artworks that they make possible or lay the groundwork for, then it's not clear that they would really be valuable. So it's sort of like a kind of buck passing problem, and unless the buck stops somewhere, the achievement of originality or the achievement of a new way of seeing the world or solving an artistic problem isn't itself going to hold up. So, okay, if this line of thought has something to it, and I'm not sure whether it's confused or not, then where do we end up? We end up saying that there are artistic values, such as originality and innovative expression and solving artistic problems and seminality and influentiality. There are artistic values that aren't themselves aesthetic values, that aren't themselves a matter of providing intrinsically rewarding perceptual imaginative experiences. But when we think about why those artistic values are values and why they are artistic values, at some point it looks as if there has to be some kind of connection with valuable experience. Or at least that's how it seems to me at the moment. The one non-aesthetic artistic value that I mentioned that I don't see a way of actually connecting to experience as such, I don't see the necessity of cashing out in terms of experience is the one that I called skill or dexterity, or the exhibition of skill or dexterity. If I push the line I was just pushing on that, it doesn't seem like it'll work. Now maybe that's a sign that it really doesn't work for the other ones either, but it may be just that skill, the exhibition of skill or dexterity in an artwork is a special kind of value. It doesn't seem like that'll work, because if you say, well, the exhibition of the incredible skill of Van Eyck in his paintings, that's really only valuable because, well, it enables us to have these experiences of looking at that demonstration of skill in the kind of, with a slack-jawed, admiring state of mind that is pleasurable. That doesn't seem right. Again, that seems to not take the lesson of the Euthyphro problem seriously. It doesn't look like what's valuable about his instantiating and exhibiting that degree of superhuman manual skill is that it allowed us to have the experience of slack-jawed, pleasurable admiration. That's not what's valuable. It's somehow valuable independent of the admiring pleasure we get. And, the Socrates side of the Euthyphro problem would say, you admire it because you recognize that it is an achievement in itself. You admire it because it's an achievement. The value of achievement is something you recognize, and that's why you get pleasurable admiration. It's not that the achievement of the skill can be cashed out in terms of the pleasure of admiring it. That somehow doesn't seem to work. But in the other case that I discussed, it seems to me that this line has more purchase. So that's where I'm going to end, and that's where my thinking on this matter ends at the moment, so far, that artistic value is a broad, multi-dimensional concept. It certainly includes things that are not, strictly speaking, aesthetic value, and what unites them together might be something like the suggestion that I mentioned from Stecker's book, that they're all values that can only be grasped by having an understanding experience of the work, even if they aren't themselves directly experiential values. But as far as some of these non-aesthetic artistic values are concerned, like originality, influence value, artistic problem solving, to see that they actually are values, and to see that they reasonably count as artistic values, it's not clear that can be done without cashing them out in terms of experiences of some artworks at some times, in some other contexts. So with that, I'll just stop and I'll let you enjoy the value of the real world.